Good evening. Is the audio okay? Can you hear? All right. Well, welcome. We are excited to be hosting Pete Bacchino with us this evening. As you've seen, Pete is going to be speaking on how to thoughtfully dialogue with unbelievers. And Pete is a guy that I've recently had some contact with here. He comes from Atlanta to us here. He is the president of Legacy of Truth Ministries. I think his website will be up if anyone's interested in taking a look at that. But Pete has a really interesting background. I'm sure some of that will likely come out in tonight's talk. But he's going to be talking to us about, again, how to engage our culture in issues of Christianity, of faith, in ways that are non-offensive, in ways that connect, and I think some very compelling ways. Pete served with Ravi Zacharias International Ministries for about 10 years, and he focused in on a lot of training people to start study groups. And again, you'll probably hear a little bit about that this evening. Pete has been a believer since 1981. He and his wife, Trace, live with their two children in Atlanta. And would you please welcome Pete Bacchino.
Well, good evening, everybody. Didn't know if we'd have anything to show tonight, so you saw us fooling around up here. I actually just have to go back and do something real quick while y'all are here. And you're thinking, what is all this about? Just gonna have to wait and see. Okay, get that out of the way. Well, it's nice to be here. I actually was just coming to Fort Collins to do a little session with some professors from CSU and then some others from around the country. And a good friend of mine who lived in Atlanta lives out here in Fort Collins, just moved here last year. Some of you, I think, know him, Ben Beard. And Ben, I called him up and I said, hey, I'm going to be in Fort Collins, you know, and maybe we get together for a meal or something like that. And great, yeah, let's see what's going on out here. So all of a sudden, I spoke last night and speaking this morning and speaking tonight and speaking tomorrow morning and tomorrow night. So I still haven't had a meal with a guy, you know. No, see, I'm really glad. I'm glad there's an interest in this area. This is apologetics or critical thinking, however you want to, you know, think about it. And I thought, first, let me introduce a little bit more personally what I do. And I have a passion. I left RZM back in 97 and have a passion to train young people before they get to college. Train them how to be critical thinkers in terms of dealing with the ideas that they're going to face. And so over the years, I went from training people my age, and I gave up on people my age anyway. And we can't even think about, you know, what we ate yesterday, let alone, you know, issues in the culture. So, you know how that goes. And then over the years, we did one of the first Veritas forums at the very first one at Harvard. And I was sitting on that committee to talk about the Veritas and what we're going to do with that. And I was very strong in follow-up. You know, I wanted to know who was responsible. After all these, you know, guys come in and speak and do their thing, what's going to happen to these students? And that wasn't really in the planning stages at that time. And so that troubled me because I really feel real convictions about discipleship. So I volunteered to go back to Harvard and sit with some of these students. And it was just a revelation to me to see how here are some of the brightest Christian students in the United States, and they don't have a clue how to academically articulate and defend their view in the classroom. And it was really a shock to me because I only had, if you heard earlier, I was only a Christian since 1981. And so I haven't even been doing this a really long time for myself, and then to see it in that dimension. And one thing led to another, and I just began to see that it was even too late to get these students in university level, in college level. And something had to be done to really get them trained before they left the church and went out to really the front lines in the cultural war. I mean, we all know what happens to a lot of students during college. And it's college and university that sets the pace for the culture. And every leader knows that if you want to change a country, you want to control the educational institutions. Some not-so-good leaders know that as well. Hitler knew that. He wanted to raise a whole generation of children who embraced National Socialism. Lenin knew that. Abraham Lincoln knew that. He said the philosophy in the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of the government in the next. And so over those years, God led me to really resign from the position I was in training adults, and I didn't know what was going to happen. And what he did was just really give me a burden for high school students. And what I learned about that is these kids are very capable of thinking for themselves. Very, very capable. If you do it right, in fact, they pick up faster than most adults do. And that's just by experience with my time with them. So as a result, what I put together tonight for you is really a culmination. A lot of young people have helped me through how to teach this better, how to articulate it better so we can understand it and see and learn from it. And the main thing, if I only have one thing to teach, it's a promise I have to the Lord. If there's only one thing I'm going to teach about, or if there's a new place where I'm speaking at, I always speak on Jesus as a master philosopher. You know, what the greatest mind that ever walked the earth. What do we know about him, and how did he do, quote, apologetics? How did he defend the faith? You know, what kind of methodology did he use? And so that's what we're going to look at tonight. We're going to go right into the New Testament, Matthew chapter 21, and take a look at his method. And by way of introduction, just to set the pace for this, I was wrapping up a training session in South Africa years ago, and it was a real long week of training, and we have leaders in from about 30 countries that flew down to South Africa. And I got on the airplane, it was just a real long week, and you know how this goes when you're traveling and you've got a heavy schedule, and I sat on the airplane, I was just so tired, and I just wanted to go to sleep, you know. And got on that plane, and so I'm looking, nobody's coming yet. I'm thinking, yeah, we're almost taking off, and there's going to be nobody sitting next to me. I'm actually praying this, oh, Lord, you know, just give me a little break here or whatever. And so as I'm praying that, you know, here's this young guy comes in, and he sits down, not right next to me, but there's a seat in between us, and sit down. So I thought, okay, well, let's see what God's got in mind here. And so as I looked over and started to engage him a little bit, he really didn't want to engage. He was just sort of wanted to be by himself. He didn't say that, but I was getting that feeling. So I thought, okay, good. You know, well, I'll just start praying and maybe go to sleep. So I turned to the right and just sending up a little prayer saying, okay, Lord, look, I'll give you a minute, you know. If nothing happens in a minute, then maybe I could just go to sleep. And here am I, you know, God's in eternity, not in time. You know, I should know that. So a minute to me is nothing to him, so it's stupid anyway, but that's what I did. So I'm sitting there praying that, and as I'm praying that prayer, this guy reaches in the seat back in front of him, and he pulls out the movie guide for the flight. Now, you all don't know me, but if you know anything about me, the two mentors in my life, one who's alive, Norm Geisler, but the other one who's not alive anymore, C.S. Lewis. And through his books and writings, has really, really influenced me. And so he turns to me, and he holds up the movie guide, and he says, Shadowlands, C.S. Lewis, you know anything about this guy? So guess who's not sleeping on this flight? And our topic tonight is, how do you dialogue? How do you have a thought-provoking, just a thoughtful dialogue with somebody who doesn't believe in God or in Jesus or in the Word of God? I mean, how do you do that? What goes into that? What are the elements of it? And I hope we could learn something together tonight from Jesus and how he had dialogues and how he engaged people. So here I am. I'm sitting there, you know, and here's what I say to him when he asked me about Shadowlands, C.S. Lewis. I said, well, you know, I do know about C.S. Lewis. In fact, he was a real influence in my life. So why don't we do this? Well, let's watch the movie and have dinner, because the movie's going to come out at dinner. And then afterwards, let's discuss, you know, the movie. He says, all right, we'll do that. So we did. We watched, you know, the movie.
I'm not sure that God particularly wants us to be happy. I think he wants us to be able to love, be loved. He wants us to grow up. We think our childish toys bring us all the happiness there is, and our nursery is the whole wide world. But something must drive us out of the nursery to the world of others. And that something is suffering.
Have you seen Shadowlands? Anybody seen that movie? Yeah. I don't know if you read the books. Grief observed his journey through the death of his wife, Joy. I mean, what I like about Lewis, he puts the cookies on the bottom shelf. He's very forthright. You know, he's not afraid to bare his soul, and he could write to the most, you know, profound intellects, and yet he could write children's books. You know, how does he do that? So after the movie, This guy was really intrigued because we took sections like this and we talked about them later. And he had never thought about this. And I conveyed some of Lewis's arguments in his journey from atheism, you know, to theism and then ultimately to Christianity, and how he really, as an Oxford scholar, saw the truth in all this, and particularly the moral argument and things like that. So this guy was, you know, just enthralled with this. He did. And I said, well, if you really like Lewis, I'll tell you what, I'll send you a whole set of the little paperback Macmillan set that I think you'll really enjoy, so I'd like to send that to you. He said, oh, no, I'll get it. I said, no, I really would like to do that. You know, just give me your address and I'll send it off to you. And he said, okay. I said, but I'll tell you what, if you like Lewis, you've got to read The Greatest Philosopher Who Ever Lived.
Yeah.
You know who I'm talking about. They said, well, who's that? I said, well, who do you think, you know, to you is the greatest philosopher ever lived? We went through everybody. Everybody, waiting for that. No, not him, no. Not Nietzsche, not Kant, not Marx, not, you know, Buddha, no, none of these guys, they all pale. Well, who are you talking about, he said. I said, Jesus. He looked at me, he said, Jesus? I said, yeah, he said, come on, what do you mean Jesus? I said, well, haven't you read how he dialogued, how he was able to control discussions, how he launched ideas that people couldn't, the scholars of the day, had no way to deal with him. They had to shut up before him. They just couldn't deal with his intellect. He said, I'd never heard of that before. I don't know about that. And then I didn't know what to say. I was caught for a minute. I'm thinking, how can I get this bridge over to open up the New Testament with this young guy? And I'm not quick on my feet. I'm a quick learner, so I really depend on God at these times. And all of a sudden, I had this thought that went something like this. I just said, well, look, you heard about Lewis from me. You saw the picture. We talked about his journey, his intellect. Who do you think he was writing about? And that got him. And he looked at me. I said, Lewis was talking about first theism and then Christ. I said, so here's the, you know, intellect that you really respect. And he said, well, I'll be open. He said, what are we talking about here? And I said, I want to just take you through a short passage in Matthew chapter 21, just show you some principles that Jesus used when he dialogued. So he said, all right. So that's what we're going to be in Matthew 21 and look at Jesus as our master philosopher. Now, it starts, I think, in verse 20 or something like that, questioning his authority. Anybody have to, I left my Bible in my room. What verse that is? 24? Okay, 23, Matthew 21, 23. And he's in the temple courts, and we're going to have a little film clip here. You can watch it, but then we could look at it together. And he's doing what he always does. He just goes in and he starts teaching. And that's the idea. Oh, that's not a good clip, is it? I know what that's
Before
happened.
I, just,
I can't do anything about it.
I will ask you a question.
We're not going to use it. I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll tell you exactly. Just go right in the text and follow it with me. So he's teaching. Here's what I want you to do as you look at the text, and I'll walk us through the text. But you are, think about this for a minute. You are in the crowd. It's Passover. 2.5 million people in Jerusalem. You've heard about Jesus. You've heard all kinds of things about him, from he's demon-possessed to he's the greatest teacher, to he's a prophet come back from the dead, you know, all these stories. And you think, you know what, I want to go hear him myself. I'm going to go to that temple. I'm in Jerusalem and find out for myself what this guy is like. So there you are. And as he's teaching in the temple courts, the crowd parts. And about 120 teachers of the law and Sadducees come down from the Sanhedrin. And the crowd just breaks apart. They walk up to Jesus and they ask him this question. By what authority do you do these things, teach in the temple, because you had to be authorized by them? So who gave you the authority to teach in the temple? And where did it come from? Who gave it to you? And the idea is that we're all here, and it wasn't any of us. Now, this is a very important question, the question of authority. Now, here's what we'll learn, first of all, from Jesus. He hardly ever answers a question with an answer. Now, I want you to stop for a minute and think about your own witnessing. When was the last time you answered a question with a question? See, we're programmed to have data for people when people don't even understand what they're asking half the time. And Peter Kraft in this quote says, there's nothing more pointless than an answer to a question that's not fully understood, fully posed. We are far too impatient with questions, therefore far too shallow in appreciating answers. If you haven't read Making Sense Out of Suffering, there's not a lot of books on suffering that really are helpful, but this is one of them. It went out of print, it's back in print, along with The Problem of Pain, C.S. Lewis. And we're answering questions that people don't even know what they're asking half the time. I had a young man at a university I was mentoring. It's local in Atlanta, and it was Emory University. And he called me up. He said, can we do a little thing on evil and suffering with some guys in my dorm and some other students? I said, yeah, we could do that. So as I was going down there, getting ready to go down, he called me back and he said, look, I've got this atheist friend, John, who really wants to come, but he's pretty abrasive. He'll be right up in your face, you know, and is that okay? I said, oh, no, that'd be fun, you know. Let's bring him along, you know. Just let him challenge all the other Christian students, you know. We'll have fun that night. So I go down there and meet this other fellow at the student center, and he says, I don't know what happened to John, so let's just go over to the room. He knows where it is. So we're heading over to the room, and then come across the lawn. Here comes John. He goes, oh, there he is right there. You know, he comes right up to me and, you know, walks right up, and he goes like this. He goes, are you our speaker? I said, yeah. He goes, I'm an atheist. I said, well, how you doing, Mr. Atheist? I'm a theist. My name's Pete Theist. You have a first name? I said, oh, you're an atheist. Yeah, I heard about you. You know, I said, but wait a minute. We stop. I said, just stop a minute. Do you know what I'm speaking on? He says, yeah, evil. I said, okay. And you're an atheist? Yeah. I said, so why are you coming to this? And he says, what do you mean? I said, why are you coming to an open forum with these students on evil and the problem of God? You know, the problem of evil and God. I mean, they're not even in your realm of your worldview. So I know why I need to say and think about it, but I don't understand what you need to say. So what do you mean by evil? What do you mean by that? And he's looking at me. He goes, well, just turn on a TV, he says, and look at the news. I said, no, those are events. I'm not talking about events. I'm talking about, what do you mean, in essence, what is it? Now, in an atheistic, materialistic worldview, what is evil, do you think? What is the basic, what is the fundamental, essential thing that exists in a worldview with no God? Just atoms, molecules. The universe is just a bunch of stuff. So we stop and I said, there's a bunch of stuff right here we're looking at on the campus. Point out evil to me. I mean, what do you have, bad molecules? I mean, good and bad? How do you differentiate? Well, he couldn't even figure this. I said, don't go. He was trying to go into my worldview in the front. I said, no. I said, you're a nice guy, maybe. Are you having a problem that I believe in God and I know that evil exists? I can take care of my own problems. Thank you very much. I said, why are you coming? I said, unless evil bothers you. Unless you think there's a, you know, whose argument was this? C.S. Lewis. Unless you think there's injustice in the world. But how do you measure that with atoms? Well, you think I, you know, it's like I took his last cookie or something standing there. I said, that's okay, you know, just come on in. You can sit there. You feel free to come. And he did. My point, most people don't even know what they're saying. Most Christians don't even know. People want to talk about truth all the time. Instead of talking about truth, you know, how do you know what you believe is true? I'll get asked that question. I said, well, that's pretty personal. Before we talk about how do I know what I believe is true, how do you know anything is true? So the questions have a simple power to them that we'll talk about. And we'll see this right here with Jesus. So they ask him, by what authority do you do these things and who gave you this authority? And he says, you know what? I'll answer your question. I have no problem answering your question. I'll answer that question. If you answer mine. And the reason why I'm going to ask this question, because it's going to be about authority. So you want to talk about authority? Then let's talk about not my authority first. Let's talk about all authority in general. Then we can talk about where my authority comes from. For example, John the Baptist. Where's his come from? Does it come from you guys or God? And that's a question. If you read through the New Testament, right at that passage, these questions come up all the time. This is all day long. He's asked questions. Pay taxes or not? And he says what? Well, before he says that, he asks a question. Whose image is on the coin? Technically a correspondence theory of truth. This coin corresponds to that reality of Caesar. Give it to him. Implied question, whose image is on your soul? God's? Give to God. What is God? What belongs to God? God doesn't want your money. You think he wants your money? He doesn't need your money. He wants you. By the way, if he has you, he has your money anyway. He wants that priority. They can't deal with this. The next one is on theological discrepancies. So whose wife should be at the resurrection? Haven't you read? He says. And he goes back to the common ground of what the Sadducees only believe in a certain part of the Old Testament, and he quotes right out of that Old Testament part that they were supposedly believing. Haven't you even read what you even believe? That's what I was telling this kid. Haven't you even read up on what you even know about your whole view, that you're an atheist? You know what that means? You know, go back and read that and see what it says. God is the God of the living. And you don't even have this right because they're not going to get married. There's no marriage at the resurrection. You don't even know what you're talking about. So you guys need to go back and study. And the next question that this other section is a different section that I like. This is really good. Here's a young man comes up, remember the rich young ruler comes up to Jesus and says, "Good teacher, what must I do in her eternal life?" Remember what Jesus says? Why do you call me good? What kind of answer is that? This is like a friend, a neighbor, a colleague, you know, somebody at work, whatever, coming to you and saying, you know, you're a good person, been watching your life, you know, you kind of got your act together. I think I'm kind of a good person, you know. And you seem to have a different kind of connection to God. So I'm missing something. I'm going, how do I get connected like you're connected? And how many times a day does that happen to you? And what you know, tell them the gospel. Hey, you want to know? This is it. But this guy doesn't even understand what good means. Remember what Jesus says? Only God is good. Let's start there first. I'm not just a good man like you. And what he does is very important. He doesn't condemn the guy. It's the three C's I said that we should never do. Condemn people, convict them, or convince them. That's not our job. That's the Holy Spirit's job. And what are we supposed to do? Just be a witness. Ask some questions. And Jesus says, okay, you want to do it? Then what does he tell him to do? You want to do it? You want to have eternal life? You. Because you got this certain idea of good. And what does he tell him to do? Keep, before he tells him to sell, he tells him to do something else. Keep the commandments. And what does Jesus say? And what does this guy say? All right, you got to get this in your head here. I've done it since I was a child. Now, you don't want to see my Bible. It's got these notes. You think, what's this guy saying? I mean, I'm stopping everything myself. This is nuts. This is like, imagine this for a minute, okay? This is Jesus, God, talking to you, saying, keep the commandments. And you're saying to him, I've done so since I was a child. Like in my mind, this is what happens. In my mind, we're going to do this again. And I go up to him and say, well, how you doing? I'm Jesus. I'm the second person of the Trinity. You must be the fourth. I mean, did you see what he said? Jesus was the only one who kept them since he was a child. And he runs into himself. I mean, what is that? But he doesn't condemn the guy. And really what he says, hey, if you've done that, then you have no problem with the first one. Go sell all your stuff because it's in the way. And the first one says have nothing between you and God. So this one would be a problem for you. Just go sell that. You want God? Here I am. You want God? Let's go. You don't need any stuff with God. I'm everything. And he couldn't do it. And he walks away. He indicted himself. I'm reading my Bible thinking, how does Jesus do this? There's no, 10-hour dissertation. You know, he just asks these questions, but they're not just any questions. So that's what we want to look at. In fact, somebody count. I tried this. You could try it yourself. I lost. I couldn't do it. 153 questions that Jesus asked of his listeners. That's a lot of questions. All right, the first thing we're going to see that Jesus has a truth principle that he's appealing to. When he says, in the question itself, where does authority come from? Either from you men or heaven. So he asked him this question, right? And it goes something like this. You're the Pharisees, and you're getting this question. You have to answer it. Where does John's authority come from? From God or from you guys? Now, they are the spiritual leaders. This is not a hard question. Because that when they go into the huddle, in fact, in Matthew's version, it says they discuss this for a long time. And they actually admit that you, the people, know the answer to this question. And they were afraid to say John wasn't a prophet because of you all. You've got to see this. These are the PhDs, the chair of each department's up here, with this simple little question that you know the answer to, and they're debating it right now. And they're in there, and I think the person was, who's the wise guy? I said, this question would trap Jesus. Where are you? You're out here. Get it. And actually, Jesus in Luke's account says, in the emphatic, answer me now. Now tell me now, tell me, where did John's authority come from? And they're in there, and if you read that right in Matthew, they're saying, hey, you know, if we say that John's authority came from God, then he's going to ask us another question. And the question is going to be, why didn't you believe him? Isn't that interesting? They already know what John said about Jesus. So they want something like this. Okay, Jesus, where does John's authority... Okay, John's authority came from God. And Jesus kind of might have said, well, what did John say about me? Well, you know, he said you were something like that. He said, you know, the voice of the Father, the Holy Spirit descended upon you. Oh, then if you know that John said that about me, then you are actually have the answer to your own question. What are you asking me? So they can't do that. But they're afraid of you all, and you're all saying, this is not our... What's going on? Oh, well, if you had a watch back then, a sundial, you know, what's going on? And what happens, they indict themselves, and they actually come up when truth is so forthright and self-evident, there's only one place you could go if you're dishonest. It's called agnosticism. And so what they say is, we don't know. Hard question, give us another one. We just don't know. Now, you're out there listening to this, and you're thinking to yourself, if you're honest, who is this guy? He took on everybody. They're all there with the little question. He didn't even say anything else. And basically said, okay, if you're not interested in truth, why are we talking? Why are we talking? And but out there in the crowd, you all, there are people out there who want to hear the truth. Now, this is a principle. Identify this as a principle question. This question identifies a truth principle. When he says, either this authority comes from men or from God, it's a simple principle in logic that Jesus is using, and it's found right in this little book. Little book, it's my granddaughter's first book, Book of Opposites. Opposites can't be true at the same time in the same sense. Up, down, opposites, in, out, opposites, back, forth, opposites. And you're saying, what are you talking about? This, illustrated in this book, is what Aristotle called the first principle of all knowledge, technically called the law of non-contradiction. Simply stated, opposites cannot be true at the same time in the same sense. When you challenge people to think about what is true, instead of about an issue, see, the issue was Jesus' authority, right? Where it came from. Well, when Jesus asked this question, they weren't thinking about just his authority. Now they had another truth principle behind it. Either all authority comes from God or it comes from you men. That's the bigger question. Where does all authority come from? And it's a question we have our whole life. Where does authority in life come from? It's either, I was speaking to a high school group in Georgia in an open forum on the who determines the value of human life. And there's only one question I put before them. Either it's going to be a group of some government somewhere or it's God. Either the Declaration of Independence is true or it's not true. And if you say that governments determine human rights and the value of life, then you can never argue against some government somewhere who decides to do something against people because they decide these people are not valuable. These kids hated that because they're not believers. I don't care. It was a crazy day. They emoted it all. I said, you can emote all you want. You can do that at lunch. I'm here to ask you these questions, and are you thinking about this or not? They try to get out of it all morning. They just couldn't get out of it. It's either or. That little principle will focus on the truth if you use it right. That's how powerful this is. In open forums at universities, last time at Georgia Tech, I was doing it on Christian ethics, and I said to the group there, the students, how many here believe that morals are relative, no absolute morals or ethics? You know, all these hands go up, and I say, well, how many believe that? I don't care how many PhDs you have or what you think about these items or these ideas, that the principle in this little book will absolutely destroy that view. You know, after they're done laughing and whatever. But I tell you, at the end of the night, it never fails. At least one student will come up and go, can I see that book? I guess I should have read this before I came to Tech. Should be standard issue for freshmen. Okay, so truth principles. There's a principle level where most people don't want to engage, but it's there. So when you're looking for truth and you're trying to dialogue, if you don't go to that level, you can get caught up in emotions. So that's the first thing. And when you use a principle like this in the right way, and I know this is kind of cold to all of you and you're not really sure about it, but I'll give you some illustrations of this in a while. And it forces people not to think about the issue that can be emotional, but about the truth of what they're saying in principle form. And this is what Jesus does by asking this question. He moves it out of the subjective, emotional realm and turns the tables and puts the burden back on them to answer this in truth, you know, in terms of a principle. And that really forces us people to think. And so this way, Jesus uses this first principle. And it's not just simple. People say, well, that's just too simple. It's not, no, 1 + 1 = 2, that's simple. E = mc². That's not just simple, that's profoundly simple. There's a profound simplicity about this law. That's why Aristotle called it the first principle of all knowledge. And Jesus uses it right there as an illustration. I call it the law of opposites when I teach, because it's just simpler to say. Opposite can't be true, opposite ideas at the same time, in the same sense. Okay, let's give you some illustrations of this in principle. So one student said to me, you know, once there is no truth. You know, and I said to him, you were just talking. I said, well, is that true? He's looking at me. Then he says, you know, no, that's not true. I said, well, is it true that it's not true? How far you want to go? I mean, we'll be here all day. As soon as you open your mouth, you're assuming what comes out of it is true. It's inescapable. This little law, you just can't get out of it. As soon as you open your mouth and disagree with somebody, you imply the opposite of your statement is false, obviously. I had a student at Princeton who was graduating with a degree in philosophy who used to be a Christian when he entered Princeton. Threw away his faith in his sophomore year. Long story, but I met him just before he graduated. And he was trying to get out of this law. He said, this law is false. I said, no, it's not false. You mean it's true? He said, no, you don't hear me. It's false. The law is not true. I said, no, you mean it. It's true. It's not false, don't you? He said, what are you saying? I'm saying it's false. I said, no, you mean it's true. See, if opposites could be true, what should he be saying when I said he's wrong? Correct. You're right, I'm wrong. And what does that mean? Nothing. It means absolutely, because he's saying the opposite, they cancel each other out. I said, you know, my little son, he's 8 years old, he knows this. You're graduating a degree of philosophy from Princeton? You better go back to Logic 101. He said, you know what? You're using Aristotle Western logic. You don't know Eastern logic. The poor guy didn't know I was over in India, you know, for years training over there, but that's okay. I said, yeah, he said, Eastern views embrace contradictions. There's a higher level, a tertiary level of logic. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, I tell you what, give me 5 minutes. Tell me about it. Took a couple minutes. He explained it. When he was done, I said, you know, he was very articulate. I understood everything he said, did a great job, but you're absolutely wrong. He said, what do you mean I'm absolutely wrong? I said, that's right, you're wrong. I said, number one, you didn't contradict yourself at all. So let me ask you a question. Did you use Western logic to explain Eastern logic, or did you use Eastern logic to explain Eastern logic? And he just stared at me. I said, you know what? It's just logic. And by the way, I was telling the story. I said, you know, I was speaking up in New Jersey, and a guy got up in the Q&A time. He said, you know, Jesus was just stealing from Socrates. This guy says to me. And then he says, and you're just using Aristotle's logic. So, you know, at that point, you're like, and I knew this guy's son, so it was like, you know, this little engagement here we're having, and I said to him, listen, stop using Newton's gravity. Will you stop it? He says, what's that supposed to mean? I said, stop using Newton's gravity. Just stop using it. He said, Newton didn't create gravity. Oh, yeah. That's right. He discovered it, didn't he? Yeah, you don't create this. If you create it, you could change it. I had a guy follow me around Atlanta once, because he hated this book. This is almost, I knew the guy a little bit, you know, and he shows up, I was speaking downtown, and I saw him in the back of the room, I go, oh, here we go again. And when it was over, he came up, he goes, still carrying this book, huh? I said, you still can't get out of this, huh? And he said, no, you understand, we create language. He said, I finally got it, we create language, therefore we create logic. Postmodern view. I said, really? The first person to create language, what were they thinking about before they created anything? No, he says. I said, yes. I said, if that's the case, here, change it. The only thing you can change it to is its opposite. You'd be using it anyway to change it. He said, I knew it. I'll be back. All right. You can't escape it. It's inescapable. First principle. You could deny it, but you have to use it to deny it. You all heard this one, all truth is personal, right? That's a favorite one. I was sitting across the table at dinner from this woman, and she definitely was passionate about this. So I had a long story, but, and by the way, this is not just a, you have to understand, and I have to say this or else I'd be remiss. This is not about just telling people they're wrong. It's about building relationships. You know, you're hearing stories, quick little slices of, and humorous to keep you, you know, not from falling asleep on me, that sort of thing. So there's a lot behind this, and there's relationships behind it, even with Eric, the fellow that I was mentioning to you. So I was sitting across the table from this lady, and it was actually the first time I met her, and we talked for a while, and simple question after a while was simply this. Is your view true, your view of truth, that truth is personal, is that true just for you? Well, think about that. If it's true and truth is personal, then it's just true for her, isn't it? But does she really believe that? If it was true just for her, she wouldn't be saying anything to me, would she? But I said, or do you really think it's true for everybody? And she said, and this is one of the most honest responses that I've gotten back, and I get it periodically. She said, you know, I've never thought of it that way. I said, you know what, I think we need to stop now, and I think you need to think of it that way and see what comes up. Because you can tell where people hit walls sometimes, you know, and they need to stop. Or else you go right by this and talk about 500 other things. Again, this simple little principle, law of non-contradiction. So you don't want to be at this personal level, and this is what Jesus teaches us. Hey, you know, people get emotional about ideas, and you don't want to be talking about that. Like I was at a university, and I won't name it because we're on tape here, and it was known to be very liberal. And when I went to speak, it's a women's, actually, college, and there were a lot of lesbians in the room, and I knew that. I was told about that. I was invited by this little Christian girl that reminded my daughter. I thought, what am I doing? I only have this conservative male going into this, you know, situation here. And it was a really interesting night, but at the end of the night, this girl student in the back said, do you think homosexuality is immoral? You know, and that's like saying, if you say yes, you know, how do you want to die? You want us to stone you, lynch you, or what? Now, I don't want to be talking about my particular view of homosexuality, although I think it is immoral. That's not going to go anywhere, is it? If I tell her the direct answer to that question. So if I don't want to be talking about it because it's very personal, and I told her, I said, that's a very personal question, and I don't have a problem answering it, and I'll talk to you personally about it later, if you think with me about all sexual behavior. So is any sexual behavior immoral at all? See, first we have to decide that before we talk about a particular kind of sexual behavior. Now, if I could get her to admit that there are some absolutes on sexual behavior, then we can decide then if something like homosexuality is immoral. But if there are no absolutes, now follow me, and everything is relative, and people have opinions about everything, then why would my opinion matter at all? Who cares? So even if I said it was immoral, I could have done it that way, but that wasn't the right way to do it. But if you don't believe in absolutes, so what? You know, I like vanilla, you like chocolate. Well, I don't like chocolate. Well, I'm going to get mad at you for not liking chocolate. What does that mean? If I don't like homosexuality, what is that? It means nothing. I didn't want to go there because I might do that in a conversation, you know, if I knew somebody. So she's back there, and I just said, so can you think of any sexual behavior you think is absolutely wrong no matter who said it's right? Now, she was smart, and she was trying to think. She didn't believe in absolutes, see? So it was a dilemma. I said, let me help you out. I have one for you. Rape. Think rape is wrong, no matter what. I said, I could give you books, two authors from the University of Arizona, who will tell you about the natural history of rape based on evolutionary theory of psychology and sexuality. But I still don't think it's right, even if we did abolish. What do you think? And she just stood there, and I said, I can see you need to think. Let's talk about it later. And she came up afterwards, and we talked. Actually, she was from Colorado. She had just moved to where I was, and it was her first year there, and we had a nice little discussion. And then I said to her privately, I said, if you know that rape is absolutely wrong no matter who said it's right, That standard goes beyond you and I. We don't have moral prescriptions for each other. It has to come from a higher level than just human behavior. And if that's the case, I can tell you my own opinion is that, yes, homosexuality is wrong based on the same principles of the standard that says rape is wrong. It's the same principle applied in a different way. That's my answer to your question. But it's not my place to judge. I know I'm not to convict, convince, or judge anybody. But that's the answer to your question. And she just said to me, I'll accept that. I said, I'm glad. I think you have a lot to think about. Now, that could have turned out a lot differently. But from Jesus, this is what we learn. You don't want to be talking about personal issues. Getting the truth level. Now, what's really fascinating about this is the parables. And we all talk about the parables. But do you know this parable that comes next in the text? I love the next statement. Right after they say, we don't know, what does Jesus say? He asks another question. Anybody see what it is? Well, right after that, then there's another. Right before the parable, he introduces the parable.
What do you think?
What do you think? I love it. It's like this. Okay, boys, look. That question too hard for you? This is too hard. Okay. What do you think? I'm going to tell you a little story. What do you think? He tells a story with two sons. And he says to one son, go in the vineyard work today. And the son says, you know, no. But he changes his mind later and he goes. The other son says, yes, but he doesn't do it. So which of these two boys is right? And without hesitation, no huddle, the first, the guy that changes his mind. In principle, it's the same principle that appeared in the principle level of truth. There's only one authority, God. And there are those who say yes to God. Like C.S. Lewis said, there's only two kinds of people in the world. Those that say yes to God, thy will be done. And those that God says to them, thy will be done. If that's the way you want it, the consequences come with it. Now, in parables are very powerful. And they don't prove anything, they just illustrate. And in the culture we live in an image world. I use them all the time, but we don't tell a lot of parables, but I use movies, books, you know, film clips a lot. You can see just from your little session here. And what they do, the second idea in here is that parables and stories help people to visualize the truth. So principles help people to think about the truth. Parables help people to visualize the truth. Anybody ever say to you, after you might tell a story or really explain something, I see your point? That's the idea. And that's what a parable does. And Jesus just took the common ideas and the common lifestyles in the culture. And through that, he would illustrate the same principles at the truth level. We had that in our culture. The Star Wars whole series. You know, with George Lucas, when he first was interviewed by Time Magazine, he said this when they asked him about the religious ideas in the movie. He said when he was growing up, he was 10 years old, he asked his mother, if there was only one God, why were there so many religions in the world? Pretty good question for a 10-year-old. And his mother didn't have a good answer. So he felt that they all had to be right. And so what you have in Star Wars is a yin-yang, you know, two dualism force. And that's what comes out in this movie. And you don't even know you're imbibing that while you're sitting there. I remember I was teaching a college group one time, and my daughter was with me. She was going to college, freshman in the first year. I said, why don't you just come with me, you know? So we went there to this group. And this is when I'm really dating myself here. Dead Poets Society came out. And I didn't see it yet. Anybody see that movie, Dead Poets Society? Okay, so most of you. And they're talking about it, and I'm setting up, and I'm hearing what they're saying, and I turn to this group I've never met before, and I just said, hey, what? That's an interesting movie. It sounds like really existential kind of movie. You know, what you do in life determines your value and meaning. And they got really upset with me. You didn't even see the movie, and you're being so negative. I don't know. I'm just telling you, that's just what it sounds to me. I said, you know what? You're all right. You're right. I'm going to go see the movie and tell my daughter, we're going to see the movie next week, and then we're going to go out and have dessert and talk about it. And that's what we did. And it was an existential. We got back next week. I said, why does this kid commit suicide? He wanted to be an actor, right? His father wanted him to be a doctor. And if existentialism is exactly that, your existence, what you do in your existence determines who you are, meaning. And if you can't really do what you think you ought to be doing, why live? There's no meaning. And that's why he committed suicide. So what you're imbibing by sitting there, now, Any good critique should be positive and negative. So with my daughter, when we went out, and you know what I learned from, I was challenged by Robin Williams, I like him anyway, to be a better teacher, be more creative, you know, engage the students. How many have seen Emperor's Club? Anybody see that one? Came out a couple of years ago with Kevin Kline. I thought it was going to be like that movie, but it wasn't. It's the same kind of setting where, and I'm going to tell you why I'm telling you about this later. You're going to see a little clip from it. But in the story, Kevin Kline plays a teacher at a private school, and the student that he pours himself into cheats on this contest where he's trying to teach character and values through and principles through the past emperors, and so they had a contest of what they knew about which emperor, and this one student cheats, but his father's a senator, and so there's all this moral dilemmas going on in Kevin Kline's mind as his teacher. Well, years later, they have a reunion, and this student is now is high up there, and he's running to be a politician. And he wants to do this contest over, and he invites some of the classmates there to do this contest over. And at that level, he was actually, guess what he was doing? He was cheating. He had a receiver in his ear from a guy in the back of the room, and Kevin Kline saw this. Now you're going to see, I'm telling you all this because you're going to see a scene in a minute. It was a really powerful scene from that movie. They were in the men's room. I'm not going to tell you anything else. And they're talking about the value system. And it's really powerful because, and I'll just hang in there, and you'll see why. So, let me just stop talking and move right into it. Oh, this is that's not going to do that one. We already talked about that. This is just the parables of Jesus. This is the one I want to get to.
All of us, at some point,
don't do this.
We're forced.
All right.
To look at ourselves
okay.
In the mirror. And see who we really.
Sorry. Let's try this again. I'm at a different resolution on my computer.
At some point, we're forced to look at ourselves in the mirror and see who we really are. And when that day comes for you, Sedgwick, you will be confronted with a life lived without virtue, without principle. And for that, I pity you. End of lesson. What can I say, Mr. Honored? About your principles and your virtues. Friends, look at you. What do you have to show for yourself? I live in a real world where people do what they need to do to get what they want. And if it's lying and it's cheating, then so be it. So I am going to go out there and I am going to win that election, Mr. Honored. And you will see me everywhere. And I'll worry about my contribution later.
That's his son.
Robert. Robert.
Powerful, isn't it? Would you say that in front of your son, who you're teaching, trying to teach values to? I was in an airplane once talking to this business guy. He didn't want to talk. He made it very obvious to me, and I wasn't even tired, so I didn't want to fall asleep. But anyway, we're flying. He wasn't really interested in much, so I saw he was married. You know, I just said, "Oh, do you have family?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Kids." Yeah, but he wanted to talk about his family, so we were talking about his family. And I said, "Well, what's some of your fears about?" You know, I said, "I'm raising teenagers, so I know I have certain fears about, are they going to, especially when they get out of the house, I said, what are your goals? What are you trying to accomplish with your kids in terms of what kind of person do you want them to be? And he was telling me a little bit about that. I said, so I said, do you have some standard? Do you believe in some kind of absolute, a prescription of the way, kids should behave or where adults should behave? Oh, no, I don't believe in that. I'm just trying to inculcate them, but to be open-minded. I said, suppose your son or daughter comes home from college one day and really is open-minded, but stands against everything you feel is right and true. Would that bother you? And he said, honestly? I said, yeah, honestly, I'd just like to know. I said, yeah, it would bother me. I said, why? Why would that bother me? I mean, if you're teaching the open-minded, you know, and hear all these things and say all these things, why would that bother you that they've come back with a different set of prescriptions of how to live their life? I mean, I really want to know, because I have a certain way I think my children should live, but I have a you know, unchanging standard behind that by which I think I should ought to live. And just looked at me, you know, and I worked for a power company at the time, Jersey Central Power and Light. And I could tell he was pressed right there. So I said, I'm sorry. I said, I didn't want to go that far. No, he said, I've never been asked that question. He said, I really need to think about it. So I said, well, you know, think about it. And this time we're kind of getting off the plane up in Boston. I said, well, let me give you my card. And I hand him my card, and he looks at me and goes, come on. I said, what? He goes, Power and Light Company? Oh, that's pretty good. I never thought of that. I have a mechanical engineering background, so I was going to a part of a committee I was on up in Boston, staying in this hotel, and the next morning I'm going down the elevator, and he had this tap on my shoulder. I turn around, it's him. He said, you know, I've been getting a lot of thought about that. I think I really need to pursue this. I said, well, great, you got my card. I didn't hear from the guy, you know, but you never know about those things. Anyway, all that to say, see how powerful this clip was? And there's so much stuff out there we can use, stories, illustration, books. I mean, I'm so thankful Lord of the Rings came out. I mean, it came out with the Harry Potter series, so I was really thankful it came out. And there's so much about Tolkien, you know, that we don't know. And I use that with the kids all the time. So anytime you can use a story. I was in the Ukraine, I've been going there every year. I do a lectureship out there once a year. And this is real interesting. A couple of years ago, I went to a conference. It's set up very well, where a Christian college, the Crimean American College in Simferopol down in Ukraine, they've set up for years, getting a couple of Western speakers in who really understand the culture and how to communicate cross-culturally. And they pick topics for you. And you choose one of the topics, and what you do is you go into either speak in the main lectureship or you go into these settings in different academic disciplines. And they put in atheist professors as well. They write as well, and they publish this little book. So I went out there, and it was really done very well because you get to know some of these different professors, different worldviews. And when I went out there before the conference, they have what they call pre-conference lectures. So I sent out a list of topics that they could choose from, and then I go. So I went to this other university I hadn't been before, and the chair of the philosophy department gave me a two-hour slot with his students. And what I did, it was so different to them because I used this questioning method. I really had to encourage them to ask me questions. And I was warned by my interpreter, this is kind of humorous, when I went when the Iraq War came out. Now, the Ukraine supported us, sent troops there, but the university students were all up against it. So all the speakers were warned from the West, do not engage questions on the Iraq War. Whatever you do, table it, talk privately about it, but don't in public engage those questions because it's too sensitive. You know. So I had a young interpreter, and I was warned like six times, don't do that. Okay. So we're going up the steps finally to this room to speak, and my interpreter turns to me and goes, oh, remember, we're not going to... Okay, I got that. So at this particular class, out of seven lecture topics, they picked social injustice and human responsibility. That was the topic they picked. So we introduced ourselves, and I set the ground rules out, and I said, okay, why did you all pick this topic? You know, I mean, there's seven topics. Why did you pick this one? Can you give me an idea? Give me an example of what you think about social injustice. Student in the back, you know what he said, didn't he?
Yeah.
The Iraq War. The United States invaded a sovereign nation. And that's wrong. I said, all right, let's go with it. This poor guy's sweating. Good question. So I said, what do you mean by wrong? Do you mean legally wrong or morally wrong? We spent an hour trying to figure this out. Because if it was legally wrong, it was legal here in the United States. We passed Congress stamp approval, so it wasn't illegal here. If it was illegal there, so what? If you just mean legal, whose laws? And we actually worked back to the Nuremberg trial, and we spent a whole hour doing this. There's a young professor there, and he was like dazed. I had the chair of the department. He had been there for quite some time. Real nice guy. So we go back to his office later, sit in his office, and they want to know how to... They were actually amazed about because I didn't answer anything. I just kept asking questions. And we kept writing stuff on the board and letting them tell me what made sense to them. And then they debated. Anyone know how to do that? I said, you really want to know how to do that? Yeah. I said, it's right in the New Testament. They didn't believe it. So we opened the New Testament because I had mine with me. Spent 3 hours there, just the New Testament. Unbelievable. Now, with all the, I'm telling you this because I'm going to wrap up here. With all the logic, philosophy, and this guy went through every philosopher he knew, and we talked about ideas, and then taking him to the New Testament, I wound up telling this young guy a story about my father's conversion a week before he died. It was unbelievable. After I tell him the story, he gets up and he walks out of the office. And he's standing in the hallway and he's walking back and forth. And I said to Evgeny, my interpreter, I said, what happened? Did I offend him? I mean, I didn't know what happened. And then his chair, this older guy is sitting there and he just got up and walked into the other room. I said, what's going on? And so Evgeny asked the older professor and he said, I don't know. So he said, let me go get some tea. And then he came back. So 5 minutes go by. This guy who's smoking a cigarette in the hallway, he comes back in and he sits down at the chair again and he hands me a coin. He said, I want you to take this. And it was a centennial coin of the liberation of Russia from the Germans. And I said, what do you mean you want me to take this coin? He said, it was my father's coin. I want you to have it. I said, I can't take that. And he said, no, I want you to have it. I said, no, I can't. No, I really can't take that. He said, would you please take it? I said, I don't know what to do. So I said, okay, I'll tell you what. I'll take it under one condition as a token of our friendship. This guy came across the table and just gave me this big hug. I didn't even know why. To this day, I really don't know why. Then he said, I want to walk you down to the... We missed our ride because we were in there for 3 hours, so we had to go take a bus. And we're walking down. He goes, I want to walk you down. I said, listen, I'm going to get you a copy. We had our book translated into Russian, so I'm going to get you a copy of that book. Would you do me a favor and look at it? That was a year ago. That was almost 2 years ago now. And God used that book and other people, of course, to bring him to himself. I met him last year. He looked me up at the conference, came there, and he said, I'm a Christian. Now, all the logic and everything else didn't do anything. It was this story. I made him, whatever it did, I still don't know, really. And I said, that's okay, I don't have to know. But God used that because he related something to that whole idea. Now, whatever it was, the power of a story. That's why there's so many parables in the Bible. Now, what I want you to think about, and then we'll end in a couple of minutes and answer some questions. Again, parables really help you visualize, the truth principles. So what we've done tonight is, all you've had is one little principle. By the way, it's in the New Testament. If you ever want to really look, technically, 2 Corinthians 10:4 and 5 says this, we demolish and destroy arguments and pretensions that set themselves up against the knowledge of God, that oppose God. Opposite. And we bring every thought and make it captive to Christ, the creator of logic. That is the essence of what we're talking about here. God created logic. Lewis said this, if you're trying to fight against God, it's like sawing off the limb you're sitting on the tree. You just self-destruct. But we don't tell people that. What we do is ask questions. Simply ask them questions, but not just any questions. So let me stop here and see if you have questions, because I'm going to ask you a question back.
Yeah.
And then we'll, if some of you have to go, you just want to be free to go, I guess. And people walk out at me all the time, don't worry, just walk out. Yeah, question.
Our family's blessed with a very young evangelist. He coined the phrase the evil place at a very young age. You go up to birthday party celebrants and ask if they know Jesus, because if they don't, they're going to the evil place. So, he's a little bit older now, he's 9. And we still have neighbors that he's witnessing to just by his strength of being, his identity and so forth. But how can we...
It's not a bad problem to have. I mean, if you had that problem, I'd pick that one with the kids. Yeah.
How can we as adults encourage the much younger generation that's not even in high school yet to apply these sorts of...
Take them right into the Bible. Just show them. In fact, the best... chapters on this in the New Testament, all the places where Jesus asked questions. And in fact, in Job, remember the end of the book of Job? 4 chapters of what? Questions from God. Yeah. Okay, Job, you got a couple of questions? Well, okay. It's an amazing thing because, Job's got some very valid questions in my mind anyway. Mm-hmm. But he's asking questions that can't really be understood in human terms, the answers. So what God does by, you know what every question's about? It's all, you know the category of questions that come back to Job, you know what they're about? Anybody? Well, okay, but what are they about in terms of, they're about nature, they're about design. Where were you when I set the planets, you know, where were you when I stretched out? They're all about design. You know, and Job's sitting there thinking, and God asks, do you know how I did this? Do you know how I did that? No, I come to think of it, I really don't know why there are these kind of orbits and stuff like that. And I don't really know that. So look, Job, you accept the universe physically, and you don't understand how it operates. And I'm the God who designed it. So maybe, just maybe, even though you don't understand your suffering, I might have a design in your suffering too. That there might be a purpose. And there's four chapters like that. And what does Job say at the end? After God uses this illustration of the universe, Job says, I heard you with my ear, but now I see you with my eye. Oh, I see your point. Just through that illustration. So, you know, take, you know, things like that, stories, and ask them what the story means. Jesus always says in place, different places, you know, what do you think, like he did with the story, who was the better son of the two sons, and that sort of thing. So that would be what I would do. Yeah.
Well, Brent mentioned you have a website.
Legacyoftruth.org. Legacyoftruth.org. There's a link on the site for the book called Unshakable Foundations, which is it moves from logic to truth, to worldviews, to science, to law, justice, evil. Oh yeah, it's right. I bought some copies, but I don't have any left with me because these professors took them. Besides C.S. Lewis, I mean C.S. Lewis would be first on my list, but this is set up. What I was looking for, the way this book actually happened was. I was trying to find, as a new believer, an engineer, one book that covered natural revelation, basically.